Ladies and gentlemen, this is Division 7 of the Colorado Court of Appeals. We have three cases set for our afternoon docket. The first case is People against Shannon Gonzer. I see that counsel are here and set up. Ms. Griffin.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Elizabeth Griffin. I'm appearing on behalf of Shannon Nelson in this case. After 4 days of deliberations, the jury acquitted Ms. Nelson of 35 counts and convicted her of one count of sexual assault on a child, position of trust pattern, one count of aggravated incest, and three counts of misdemeanor child abuse. I want to just quickly discuss an issue that I'm afraid may have been buried at page 77 in my giant brief, and that is the court's refusal to permit questioning or a challenge to juror N, who was seated late. And the reason I want to start with that is because juror N, when asked what was on her mind, said she questioned why the children would be so angry as to want to accuse their mother of sexual assault if she were innocent. The jury in this case did hear that Shannon was married at 19, raised an autistic boy and three kids with ADD, largely on her own, that she did yell and spank them and tried to keep order in the house, and that she did everything for them. And they heard that there were never any complaints or suspicions of abuse until one day she left them. The jury did hear that Lee felt very betrayed and angry, and they saw that Diana hated Shannon. And S, the youngest and least sophisticated, explained how the hurt from their mom abandoning them was later replaced by bitterness and anger, as her dad explained to her how things were. And S also told the jury how she worked on her allegations with her Aunt Diana. And where the jury got this information, where they got the context that they needed to understand the allegations, they acquitted Shannon. And they acquitted her of all the counts relating to S. But the court kept from them evidence that they needed to assess D's credibility and understand how or why he could have made untrue allegations. The context and credibility was crucial because there was no other evidence of Shannon's guilt of these charges that she is now serving a life sentence on. Juror N and all of the jurors needed to know that C was charged with sexually assaulting a neighbor and that he was in counseling when he started the allegations against Ms. Nelson. They needed to know that D had submitted the statement that was apparently not written by him with implausible allegations and allegations of abuse by other people. The denial of the opportunity to question or challenge juror N, in and of itself, even though it's buried at page 77, requires reversal and a new trial in this case, because that juror, as the court knows, was sexually assaulted at the same age that C and D were saying they were sexually assaulted. She had a son the age of C and 1 year older than D at the time of trial. She was good friends with a police officer, had been a robbery victim, and she made this comment about not understanding how these allegations could even be false, and no questioning was allowed.
Ms. Griffin, if you could, since we have limited time, I'd like you to discuss the issue of the exclusion of the letter that D wrote about his experiences with his mother and his aunt and uncle.
That's where I was going right now, Judge. The court basically suppressed this information that D said he was assaulted by Roy and Lacey during the same period charged, and the nature of this allegation, which was also very important. The prosecutor in this case used the rape shield statute to suppress these allegations because they hurt the case against Ms. Nelson. They made D look less credible, and without that letter, Ms. Nelson's guilt seemed inevitable because there was no other explanation for D's problems. But that was incorrect, because if the conduct is between the victim and the defendant, as it was here, then the rape statute doesn't even apply. And if it was offered for the source of a physical condition or to show that the acts charged were not committed by the defendant, as here, it doesn't apply. And the defense here filed the rape shield motion. They followed the procedure. They brought this to the court's attention before trial and asked for this to be admitted because it was obviously relevant to the allegations. It was relevant to provide context and a complete picture of the allegations. It was relevant to Dee's credibility since he said that he had typed this statement, and it seems so clear when you compare it to his other statements and drawings and his testimony and his video, and I encourage you to watch the videos, that this boy didn't type this statement, but so, he said he did.
So would the theory on credibility be that Dee offered a variety of stories that conflicted and was constantly changing his story?
That would be one theory of credibility. There are a couple reasons why this impacted his credibility. Sure, one is he said initially said nothing happened, and then he said, oh, it only happened in the closet. And then he says, he says that he's saying the things in this type statement, which are of a completely different sort. And then at trial, he's regressed to only being able to say rape and sexual assault and rape. It's inconsistent. And the fact that the nature of the allegations so clearly indicate that he didn't make them is relevant to his credibility.
How does it come in if he didn't make them? I thought the theory was this is his statement. So it comes in, and then you want to get it in and then say he didn't make it.
It comes in because he says he made it. Because if a person says, I typed this two-page statement explaining what happened to me, but really their brother did it or their aunt did it, then they're lying.
But it
shows their willingness to lie and to go along with the family story about the allegations. And it would be up to the jury to decide, you know, whether that's what happened or whether, well, gee, no, we think this is important because we think what he said in that statement is true.
So for purposes of authenticating the document, you want the court to rule that it was his statement, because the court has to make that ruling, and then you want to turn around and say, but it wasn't his statement, he didn't make it at all.
Well, there's no issue of authentication, because we know that he handed that statement to his therapist, and he handed that statement to the detective.
But okay? If it's not his statement, even though he handed it to the therapist, it would be hearsay.
He claimed it was his statement.
Counsel? You claim it wasn't. I mean, how can you take inconsistent positions in seeking the admissibility of a document?
Well, I think that's what the prosecutor was trying to do, was take inconsistent positions in terms of which evidence was presented to the jury. All the evidence that supported my client's guilt came in, and anything else didn't. Did you have a question, Judge?
Judge Jones. I mean, isn't your better argument here or that the problem here is the prosecution put on witnesses that basically relied on this letter? I got, you know, the therapist said, I got details from Dee, and, you know, essentially said, I found them truthful, or I didn't see any reason to question their credibility. And they, you know, only allegations against mom, mm-hmm. defendant. And the problem, I think, is that, you know, the prosecution ran with that, and you would use the letter to say, here's what he really said, and this is what the whole case was based on. These allegations weren't from him. That's the prejudice, isn't it?
Well, that's the second part of my argument, Judge, and I think that's the easy part. That's what I call it in the reply brief, because I think even if you disagree about whether this was admissible to begin with, they open the door because they do what you're saying. They mislead the jury. They basically present false testimony. I mean, they're picking and choosing from this therapist's notes, and they're making it sound as if the kid was talking about my client when he was talking about somebody else. I mean, they can't do that.
Well, he's talking about both, I think.
Right.
The letter kind of mentioned both, which brings me to, I was going to ask you for your, I'm not clear on your theory under the rape shield statute. First, you said these are allegations against, between the victim and the defendant here, therefore it comes in. But there, you know, part of your argument is, but the letter also has allegations about you know, the aunt and uncle.
Right.
And so I don't think you fit under that exception. And I guess long-winded way of asking you, can you articulate for me the theory of admissibility under the rape shield statute here? And maybe it's a number, a couple of alternative arguments,
yes.
But I'm not sure I got,
yeah.
I'm tracking.
Well, first of all, my argument that it involves my client, that's what takes it out of the rape shield entirely, right? And that's what the defense attorney argued below. That's one of the things he argued, is that because these allegations involve my client, you don't even have a rape shield hearing. But we filed the motion anyway. He didn't have to file the motion, in other words.
Does that argument apply even if there are allegations against other people as well in the same document?
Well, the statute doesn't get that technical, but it says if the allegations are between the victim and the defendant, and some of these involved my client. Now, more of them, I would say, involve the other people. So that's just one argument. One argument is that the statute doesn't even apply. But even if the statute applies, it was invoked properly. The motion was filed, you know, the procedure was complied with, and it was relevant. It only has to be relevant to come in. The rape shield statute, the function is not to keep out relevant evidence or evidence that hurts the prosecution. It was relevant because it's the context of the allegations that this kid is making, and it's a potential alternate source of his difficulties, his trauma, or what have you. It's a source, potential source of his, you know, knowledge about sexual matters. And I think that the letter itself, in the form that it's in, is highly relevant to any assessment of this kid's credibility because it does not appear to have been written by him. Now, I'm not saying it wasn't written by him. This is all up to the jury. And the problem is the jury wasn't allowed to make any of these determinations. I mean, this letter, however it comes down and whatever the jury makes of it, it's really relevant because he says, this is my statement. And that was kept from the jury. And he's making allegations that are inconsistent in kind with anything he said before or after. And he's saying, other people did this stuff to me. That can't be kept from the jury. And that is part of the reason I think juror N is important, because these jurors are going to have these questions. They want to know how and why could this have happened and what's the context. And they weren't given the context with respect to this kid. And as I said, it's clear that once the prosecutor misleads the jury by just going for broke and just going crazy and having the therapist misrepresent the evidence, even if it wasn't admissible initially, under the Melillo case, it becomes admissible because the door's been opened and the jury's been misled. I would just like for you to rule that it was admissible in the first place. Next, I'd like to talk about the suppression of the fact that C had this charge when he initiated the allegations. Do I have 2 minutes left?
Yes, ma'am.
The court wouldn't even review the file in this case because the court so misunderstood the rape shield statute and my client's constitutional rights to present a defense and confront witnesses. This evidence, the fact of the charge and the timing of the arrest, the charge, what was going on in his case and what was going on in this case, was really important for the jury to know. And the defense lawyers were kept in the dark on this. And I'm asking you to look at the register of actions in this case. I can't do that because I've been told I'm not supposed to, because it's a juvenile case. The trial attorney couldn't do that. He wasn't a public defender. He couldn't do it even if he wanted to. He didn't have access to it. So we've been kept completely in the dark. And it's important for a judge to look at this and decide if it was relevant.
Ms. Griffin, let me ask you, assuming we agreed with you that, you know, it goes to, there's a potential for a desire to curry favor, might show bias. What difference does it make when all the allegations regarding C, your client won?
Because C is the older child and D's allegations followed C, and presumptively because of their relationship and the pecking order, and if you watch the videos, it's real clear what the pecking order will be. D may have been influenced by C.
But why would it go to, I don't understand how those two arguments fit together.
Because the jury needs to understand where these allegations came from in the first place.
But the jury, the reason the prior convictions would be relevant to show bias, the jury, or impugn C's credibility. The jury obviously concluded C was not credible. So I guess I'm still not sure why that would affect.
Because they believe D, and they need to see that there may have been a reason that C was influencing D. I'm going to save my 10 seconds for rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the court, Patricia Van Horn, registration number 30,002, and I represent the people in the matter. This evidence, the evidence of D's allegations in the letter and the evidence of C's case, was inadmissible under the rape shield statute. Neither piece of evidence falls within an exception, and the defendant failed to overcome the presumption that it was irrelevant.
Ms. Van Horn, what about the opening the door argument? It seems to me that the prosecution deliberately got some of this evidence in through the back door by having this witness testify as to the details, not specific details, but that she was given details by D, and those details, as we know, came from the letter.
Not all the details that the therapist was given by D came from the letter.
But we know that some of them did.
And, right.
And so why can't then there be cross-examination as to the contents of that letter?
Because it's still precluded under the rape shield statute, I suppose you could X out the allegations involving the aunt and the uncle and just leave the ones involving the defendant. But, and if you look at this, all the therapist said was explaining the course of treatment and
Are you saying it's barred by the rape shield statute even if the prosecution opens the door to it?
In this situation, it is, and I don't think the prosecution opened the door to this. The witness, as to the letter, merely testified that D had shut down for a while and had stopped talking about the sexual assaults, and then when he said he could talk about them again, he had a letter and he came in, and after the therapist read the letter, he was able to start talking about the abuse again. So the therapist was just describing this to explain sort of the course of therapy, how D had mentioned it and then shut down and wouldn't talk about it and then did again once he supplied this letter. And the defense wanted that bit of testimony in for its own purpose, to get in the one allegation that D made in the letter that his brother C had walked in during one of these incidents. And I think a fair reading of all this, they just wanted this letter in to attack this child's credibility. That's why they wanted it in, because it sounded so,
that
they didn't believe any of this was true. And since now we know that the uncle and the aunt have both been convicted of sexually assaulting these children, you can see what would have happened had we brought this all in.
Well, you just said credibility. He's the accuser. Why doesn't the defendant have the right to attack the credibility of the accuser, rape shield statute or not?
It doesn't fall in as an exception. This was just a general credibility attack.
So you're saying that credibility determinations are excluded by the rape shield
statute? If it involves prior sexual activity, which this did.
That's a pretty expansive view of this. That raises some real constitutional questions.
No, if you're using prior sexual activity to attack someone's credibility, that's prior sexual activity. It's nothing more than that. So it does fall under the rape shield statute.
But if the theory is the accuser keeps changing his story, he says this one time, then that, then something else, and then this letter comes out with something completely different.
I don't see that he kept changing his story. I see he was a small child who kept coming up with more details, who was traumatized.
Well, that's an argument to make to the jury, sounds to me. But he is changing his story. He's adding he's not just adding details, he's adding events.
First time he said no sexual assault happened.
Oh, I think these children all denied it initially, and then gradually it came out. And then ultimately, all the adults that were described in this letter were charged with sexually assaulting these children.
So my understanding, your argument here is that all that happened was that the children just added more detail as time went on?
From what I can see, the children added more detail. And of course, when these kids were first interviewed, they were 10, 9, 10, 11, those ages. And I can see at times they, the therapist said they would shut down, they would talk about it more, they were all different. But bottom line, what this comes back to, these are allegations concerning prior sexual activity involving this boy, involving other people. That's excluded under the Rape Shield statute unless you overcome that presumption of irrelevancy, which never was done here.
Ms. Van Horn, here the prosecution seemed unable to pinpoint a specific incident involving D that they were charging the defendant with. It could have been any of the incidents in the letter.
They didn't. There was some point they said, and I don't know where that is in the record, they said we're not charging her for any of the conduct that occurred. It doesn't encompass any of the charges.
But that wasn't, I don't think that was really made clear to the jury. There was this kind of amorphous theory that over time this all happened.
And it, yes.
And that time period included the time period covered by the letter.
Correct.
Wouldn't the letter also, in addition to just going to credibility, point to alternative suspects? If sexual assault occurred, it occurred at the hands of other people.
And the defendant, because she was involved in this. It wasn't just
relevant.
It wasn't. It was the defendant. Well, the defendant was involved with these other people, but this involved sexual activity involving him as a victim.
Correct. But what I'm saying is
that. So that's Rape Shield statute,
but,
right
but it
there.
Doesn't it point to another perpetrator? If evidence points,
it points to additional perpetrators, the
well,
mother.
That's your theory, but why isn't the defense entitled to argue that it points to another different perpetrator?
But that I don't think that was ever their purpose. They were never saying that this shows that the aunt and uncle were the abusers, and they couldn't because the defendant's name was my mother got me and took me into my uncle's room. She was involved in the sex acts with the uncle, so they couldn't pull her out of it. They were just trying to get this letter in to make this boy look like he was just making stuff up. And the big argument in the trial court was, well, see, the prosecution hasn't charged those two with anything, so that's why they were trying to make it like those. And they still are. They're still characterizing the tone of that letter as though that boy didn't write it.
Well,
but it describes sexual activity he was involved in,
Ms.
so
Van
it
Horn,
falls under the Rape Shield
why
statute.
Why is the defense entitled to argue that the accuser is just making it up? I mean, that seems to me to be pretty constitutionally based there, that this is a false allegation. And in fact, from the verdicts, we know that the jury didn't believe the other accusers.
Right. And but part of this is, this falls under the Rape Shield statute. That's the bottom line. I mean, people used to bring in other sex before we had the Rape Shield statute. That's exactly what would happen. Somebody would bring in somebody's allegations and things about someone's sex life to cast doubt on somebody's credibility.
Ms. Van Horn, let me bring you back to the statute here, because I'm not under. I agree with Judge Jones. Your read of this statute seems to be broader than anything I've ever heard. Would you agree there's a rebuttable presumption of irrelevance?
Yes.
Right. So if there's a showing of relevance, it would be admissible, right?
Right.
Okay. And so is your position that there was no possible relevance at all to this letter?
Yes.
Okay. And I want to come back to Judge Jones's question about opening the door. As I recall, the therapist, Dr. France, told the jurors that D gave him a letter regarding abuse by the mother. And this letter had details. When the jury didn't hear any details from D himself, why does that not open the door? So the prosecution's arguing, gee, here's a therapist telling me I got details about the abuse by mom, therefore that's good enough. Why isn't the defense entitled to then say, let me show you what the details were? They're about uncle and aunt.
And they're also about the mother. The mother's
fine,
in that
fine,
letter,
but
too.
Isn't that for the jury?
No, I don't think so in this case. Not at all. Not at all. I think that the prejudicial effect was far outweighed any possible probative effect this
What's
could have
the
had.
What's prejudicial effect?
Because they're trying to paint him, and they still do it, making it like, oh, this little boy couldn't have written this letter. These terms are, and this idea, these things sound crazy, and these two people haven't been charged. Well, I would say, well, we'll stop it then. We'll show you these two people have been charged. In fact, now these two people, both of them now, have been convicted of sexually assaulting these two children. It opens up a whole other thing with two more defendants. I think it would let all that take over this trial.
So you're equating an attack on credibility with prejudice. I mean, you're saying that they're saying that D is making this up. Well, That's a pretty straightforward defense to a criminal case.
But,
I mean,
but the Red Shield statute isn't used just to allow someone to make a general attack on another person's credibility. That's all they were trying to do
this
here.
This has to do with the incidents at issue in this case. It's not something extraneous.
No, it's a very small part of years of abuse suffered by this.
It's part of it.
Right.
All right. So if it's part of it, why can't the defense get into it?
Because it involves two other people, that falls under the Rape Shield statute. This is irrelevant. It is entirely irrelevant here.
You know, they keep saying irrelevant. And
it was under the Rape Shield statute.
No,
they have
that's just a presumption. That's
right.
Just a presumption. And then you go a step further and say credibility is irrelevant. Alternative suspect, irrelevant. I don't understand that.
Because I think, okay, in order for this to come in, had I been the prosecutor and the judge had ruled that this could come in, you'd have to put the aunt and uncle on the stand. You'd have to go through all that information to find out exactly what happened here. Same thing with the case involving C. It would have let all this take over this trial. That's the prejudicial problem.
That's a 403 analysis. That's not
right.
A relevance issue. That's
right.
That's an issue of whether
I don't think it was relevant under the Rape Shield statute because it does not, and it doesn't fall into any of the exceptions. That's clear. I think we can agree that it does not fall into any of the exceptions. Now, if you want to say that it's relevant, that you can bring in this sort of evidence just to attack somebody's credibility, then we start doing the 403 analysis, and that's, I win on that. Because it would have let this sideshow take over the circus here.
How is it a sideshow if the allegations involved the victim and the defendant?
Because I think we would have needed the aunt and uncle to come in and testify.
Well, you frequently have other people testifying. You have witnesses.
Right.
How is that a sideshow?
They're going to have their own attorneys come in because they're getting ready to be charged. And I don't know specifically when they were charged in this case, but they're both defendants. They're both charged with sexually abusing these children.
Okay. So I'm still not understanding how it's a sideshow when the allegations in the letter involve both the victim and the defendant.
When they involve the victim and defendant, generally prior sex between a victim and a defendant is only relevant when it's consensual, and we know it wasn't consensual. I mean, that's the presumption of relevancy is when it's consensual sex, and it certainly wasn't consensual.
Counsel, I think the problem is that the theory of relevancy doesn't really depend on the fact of prior sex. It has to do with the incongruous nature of the way that the sexual activity was described in the letter, which doesn't seem to jive at all with the nature of the victim's testimony and other statements out of court. Why? And your view is that this tension between these two things, supporting an attack on credibility, would not be the kind of thing that could overcome the presumption of irrelevance that's in the Rape Shield.
Correct.
If we disagree with you about that, do you agree that the case has to be reversed?
I don't think the case has to be reversed. I don't. I mean, I am firm in my belief that this, nothing about this overcame the presumption of irrelevancy in the Rape Shield statute. Nothing above it. Nothing about it at all. It's almost opening the door to this idea. Anytime you want to attack someone's general credibility, you can bring in a lot of stuff. And that's what you would be doing if you said this should come in. You could say, I can bring in all kinds of stuff about prior sex activity because I need it to attack the credibility of this victim.
But the Rape Shield statute is intended to prevent a kind of credibility argument that is based upon the mere fact of having sex, okay? Promiscuous sex, whatever it happens to be, the mere fact of it. But here we have these discrepancies between the descriptions of what D claimed to have been involved in and what the defendant was claimed to have done. So it's not the fact of the sex.
I don't see the discrepancies,
It's the inconsistencies.
I don't see the discrepancies. I guess that's where I don't see any great discrepancies here. I see the common discrepancies of somebody who's trying to explain something that happened to him.
What about in the difference in the use of language? We have other writings and drawings that D made. This letter has there's no comparison between this letter, the language used, the descriptions of the sex acts. Doesn't it become relevant because the defendant had an argument here that, you know, this would, even if this, assuming this young child D wrote this, someone was coaching. You know, compare it to.
You know, they could have brought that out in the trial court. They could have had. They could have brought that out. They could have
they
had
tried.
A.
They
could, no, no. They could have had a pretrial hearing trying to establish this wasn't written by him. Called in people, questioned people. They never asked for that. They never asked for that at all. They could have taken care of this prior to trial if they wanted to. If that's what they wanted to establish, that this letter was not written by this boy or his brother helped him, and his brother's only a year older, you know, and these kids.
Or their or the aunt helped them. I mean, that's part of the.
And they could have had a hearing on that. They chose not to have a hearing on that specific issue about the author of the letter. There's just a lot of innuendo and a lot of somebody's idea of words children use and words children don't use. And I've been around a lot of kids in my life, and I know they sometimes surprise you with their vocabulary and the things they know. An adult certainly didn't, a very illiterate adult, but an adult doesn't appear to have written that letter. Rambles, no punctuation, miss, I'm out of time, various misspellings, that kind of thing. So they could have had a hearing on it. They chose not to do that.
Ms. Van Horn, I have one more question on this. As I recall from the record, the therapist testified that because of the detail with which she was provided by D, and we know that part of that was the letter, she thought he was honest. So she continued. She thought that now he's being honest with her.
I don't remember that that was
the
sequence.
She believed him, something to that effect. Am I misremembering that?
No, I know at one point one of the therapists said, in response to a question, did you, it was basically, and it was about C. Did you think C was lying, or did you think C? And one of the therapists said.
There's a potential confusion because C's therapist made some statements and D's therapist made some statements. If I recall correctly, D's therapist had to do with something to the effect that when D gave me the letter, he seemed to sigh
and
give a sigh of relief.
And there was no evidence that he was fabricating.
No, I know that's not then.
I think D's, Dr. France testified that got the letter from D. D was relieved after handing it over, saw no evidence to show that D was fabricating. That's what Dr. France said.
I think that was in response to a specific question. What kinds of evidence do you look at? How do you know somebody's telling you the truth or not telling you the truth? And the answer was something like, well, in this case, I had no evidence that D was fabricating, which, of course, isn't the same as offering an opinion of someone's truth.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
The therapist, Mr. France, also said that with all the other kids he's treated except for one where the details didn't add up, he determined and social services determined that they were true allegations. And so he vouched for D in that way as well. And the letter did not prompt, the therapist didn't testify the letter prompted D to start talking more. The letter was the detail that was provided to the therapist. I would just ask the court also to compare that letter to Diana's written statement in evidence, because that adult could have written this letter. I would just ask the court to reverse Ms. Nelson's convictions. Thank you.
Thank you. Difficult case, and the court would like to thank both counsel for their excellent briefs and their excellent arguments. This case will